the Sunday service committee was scheduling our service for this spring, we needed to have a service for April 1st, and I used my auction purchase of a sermon to have Herb Ogden speak. I had hoped that he would take the opportunity to give a talk that would take advantage of the fact that it was April Fool's Day. However, since the day was also Easter, Herb felt that any pranks would be inappropriate. We also had to fill this Sunday, and when I realized it was April 15th, I volunteered to do a talk on taxes. First, I'll digress a little bit and give you a story that combines taxes and an April Fool's type day. Late in 2016, Bill made a very ill-advised and not small bet with Herb regarding a hike up Mount Escutney that Bill said he'd never taken and that Herb said the two of them had done the previous year. As soon as Herb returned home, he sent photographic evidence that the two of them had, in fact, done the hike. Bill dutifully paid, and I would add, has not bet with anyone since then. As a prank, we sent Herb an IRS form reporting gambling winnings, a W-2G. We used a fictitious provider number and inserted wording in the signature block to indicate that we did not attest to the accuracy of the information provided. We sent this in a very serious-looking envelope marked Important Tax Information enclosed. We were hoping that Herb and Kathy would find this humorous. We waited for their response, and waited, and waited. Kathy finally called and rather sheepishly said that we need to redo the form because their accountant said the provider number wasn't a real one. Finally, we had a big laugh together. My point is, in part, that we tend to take taxes not only seriously, which is appropriate, but we fail to see the bright side, or in this case, the intended humor. For any of you who have not completed your return for 2017, there is good news. The deadline for this year is not April 15th, but April 17th. Anyone know why? Aha! I thought it had to do with the fact that returns for New England have gone to Andover, Massachusetts, and that April 16th, besides being the day of the Boston Marathon, is a state holiday, Patriots Day, also celebrated in Maine. How many of you have the same understanding? Okay. I assume that since this year's federal tax filing due date is April 17th, that Patriots Day is the reason. Not so. We no longer follow the due date in the state where our return is filed because we don't file regionally anymore unless we are filing a paper return and sent in because we file a paper return, sending a payment for Vermont residents means that you're going to be sending it to Kansas City, and if you're not requesting a refund, it goes to Hartford, Connecticut. So Andover, Massachusetts, no longer. The reason that we have April 17th, does anybody really know? Very close. It is a DC holiday. It is Emancipation Day, celebrated since the early 2000s. It's celebrated on April 16th this year and commemorates the signing by Abraham Lincoln of an act which freed slaves in the district and paid the owners compensation by the federal government, the only time when this kind of compensation was paid. So the good news for those who haven't filed, and I know at least one of us here who hasn't, is that you have 2 days left. Not a lot of time, not enough. There's more good news. The IRS grants individual taxpayers an automatic extension of 6 months to file a return. Now I'm going to give you a brief non-disclosure. I'm not a CPA, professional tax preparer, tax attorney, or anything resembling those professionals. Anything I say should be taken with a grain of salt and verified before you rely on it. Having said that, the automatic extension is a great opportunity if you find yourself in a time bind, but the IRS expects you to file your extension with payment of the estimated amount of taxes you'll owe. Failure to make this payment, if one is due with the request for the extension, will result in the IRS charging interest and potentially penalties. I recently completed 3 years as the Vermont representative to the Taxpayer Advocacy Panel, or TAP, a federal advisory committee to the Internal Revenue Service. On the panel were citizens from retirees like me to tax attorneys to a nuclear physicist to a chief state highway engineer. TAP is part of the Taxpayer Advocacy Service, which is an independent organization within the IRS and definitely the bright side of the IRS. TAP is charged with listening to taxpayers, identifying systemic taxpayer issues, and making recommendations to the IRS. This past year was particularly gratifying as our individual committee dealing with tax forms and publications made a record number of recommendations, many of which were adopted by the IRS. Also within the Taxpayer Advocacy Service is the local taxpayer advocate. Each state has at least one, and Vermont's is in Burlington. Has anyone here ever dealt with that office? Okay. If you ever have a situation where the action or inaction of the IRS is causing you financial hardship, or where the IRS has not met the timetables it has met for resolving an issue, you may be eligible for services of the local taxpayer advocate. I don't think there is any tool for getting through a large, entrenched bureaucracy more effective than the local taxpayer advocate. The Taxpayer Advocacy Service also includes the National Taxpayer Advocate, currently Nina Olson. The advocate regularly reports to Congress on how the IRS could be functioning better and can make legislative proposals directly to Congress, the only individual in the IRS who may do so. She regularly criticizes the service for its shortcomings, but also advocates for funding that will allow the IRS to fulfill its mission, which is to collect taxes to allow the government to function. Unfortunately, the IRS is so unpopular that cutting its funding is seen as positive. The funding for service in real dollars has gone down year after year. The National Taxpayer Advocate was instrumental in the adoption by the IRS of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, an important statement of what the taxpayer may demand of the IRS. This includes the right to be informed, the right to quality service, the right to challenge the IRS's position and be heard, and a number of other rights. It has an echo of the seven principles. When I finished my 3 years on the panel, I received this recognition with the now famous signature recognizable to all, I think even from the back row. One of the most important factors for keeping religion and government at least somewhat separate is, in fact, taxes. Churches and other 501c3 nonprofit agencies are exempt from income taxes, and it can be argued that this exemption is critical to the functioning, the financial stability of these organizations. And I see the chair of the Canvas Committee nodding. Certainly, we would have immediate concerns if our revenues were subject to tax. Additionally, contributions of individuals to these tax-exempt entities are potentially exempt from tax, making the amount of these contributions arguably larger than they would be otherwise. Much of the following discussion on the Johnson Amendment, named for Lyndon B. Johnson, comes from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the FFRF. The Johnson Amendment specifies that tax-exempt groups may, quote, not participate or intervene in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for political office, unquote. The reason that the Johnson Amendment exists is to ensure that churches and other nonprofits engage in charitable works, not political campaigns. The Johnson Amendment does not mean that churches can't sermonize or comment on moral issues such as war, abortion, civil rights, or poverty. Churches can even comment on the job performance of public individuals. Trump's statement that overturning the Johnson Amendment as it applies to churches would be, quote, my greatest contribution to Christianity, unquote, while true, to me is a clear violation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, which states that, unquote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, unquote. The repeal of the Johnson Amendment would provide incentive to divert campaign contributions to churches, making them deductible and costing the taxpayers over $2 billion in lost revenue over 10 years, according to the Chief of Staff of the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. That's $2 billion that would likely be diverted from taxation to churches if the Johnson Amendment were overturned. Churches would become a source of money for political campaigns, untraceable and unregulated, turning into super PACs. FFRF states that overturning the Johnson Amendment would make the Citizens United decision look trivial. One can conclude that the enjoyment of tax-exempt status coupled with the Johnson Amendment has kept churches and not-for-profits out of endorsement of political campaigns for political endorsement of political candidates, but not out of the political arena entirely. My understanding of the law has changed. I was not aware of how much advocacy is permitted. We UUs, since we are so law-abiding, may not be taking full advantage of the bully pulpit. As we went through the time for all ages, it is clear that taxes are paid for the common good, safety, education, the safety net, and now another bright consequence of taxes. Happiness. Happiness is certainly a personal aspiration, but rarely articulated as a national one. A continuing poll of the happiness of countries released its most recent results. In the first place is Finland, followed by Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Canada, New Zealand, Sweden, and Australia. You have to go to 18th place to find the US. The factors used to determine happiness are income, healthy life expectancy, social support, freedom, trust, generosity, and the self-reported well-being. Finland and other Scandinavian countries are seen as the least corrupt, safest, and most socially progressive. Not surprisingly, all of the countries in the top 10 have some form of universal health care. Nowhere in this list is tax burden. You don't see that from the list. Yet, of all these 10 countries, only three, Australia, Switzerland, and New Zealand, have income tax burdens lower than the US. The personal income tax burden on the average Finn is almost 50% higher than that of the average American worker. By one measure, the personal income tax rate in Sweden, a pretty happy country, is 62%, as opposed to 37% in the US. Finland, in that ranking, had a rate of 52%. On that ranking, which was personal income tax burden, eight of the happiest countries had rates higher than the US. That's personal income tax. And that's only Canada and New Zealand had lower rates. Total tax revenue as a percentage of GDP, which is what's taken out of the economy for taxes, tax revenue as a percentage of GDP lines up even more closely with happiness. For example, the top four, Finland, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, were among the five countries taxed at 50% or more of GDP. The only other country at that high a level was Timor-Leste, which may be a happy place, but not one that is easily located. Anybody know where it is? Okay, where is it?
It's north and east of New Guinea.
Yes, it used to be part of Indonesia. Yes, it is. He knows where it is. Was that your answer?
Okay.
Similar. Okay.
Yes,
yes. With all these happy places devoting 50% or more of GDP to taxes, where does the U.S. stand by the same measure? 26%. Not as high as many would assert. I'm not arguing that paying higher taxes will make us happier. I would look further into what the country's priorities are for their tax dollars. The Scandinavian countries, in particular, as so-called social democracies, spend large amounts of their national budgets on social programs. For example, Finland spends 31% of its GDP on social welfare, with the other Scandinavian countries following closely. Of the 10 happiest countries, only Austria and Iceland Australia and Iceland spent less as a percentage of GDP than the U.S., which was at 19% of GDP. So perhaps spending on health care, parental leave, vacations, and education enrich the countries in ways that benefit society's mental health and happiness. Most of these figures were derived from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a highly respected research organization supported by 35 member countries, including the U.S. Now we get to the more microeconomic level, the personal one. I have been doing my own tax returns, with the exception of 2 years prepared by a CPA, for more than 50 years. So much has happened in those years to me, to tax preparation, to technology. Surprisingly little has happened to the tax filing itself. I looked up my oldest tax returns and I found them going back to the late 70s. This was a much simpler time. I was single, I filed in one state, and I didn't itemize my return because I wasn't a homeowner. In 1978, I filed my one-page, one-sided Form 1040A, and my copy shows only the entries for dollar amounts on six lines, even though I filled out the whole form when I sent it in. These were the only entries that would vary based on my income and taxes. The reason I don't have all the entries on the form is that I was lazy. Entries had to be copied by hand onto the second copy of the form. We didn't have copy machines in those days. We barely had carbon paper. My life changed over the next several years, with 1979 more complicated. I filed again, a one-page 1040A with two state forms for Vermont and Maine. And for Maine, it required a long form where I actually filled out two sides of the form. By 1981, I was a homeowner and filing a 1040 two-sided with a Schedule A. For itemizing deductions, because I had now purchased my first house and was paying state income tax, real estate tax, and general sales tax. Yes, we could deduct a portion of our income as sales tax back in those days. I also deducted my interest on credit cards, which we could do, and my charitable contributions. Back then, it was possible to take a tax credit, not just a deduction, for contributions to candidates for public office. I don't have the instructions from that year to indicate the maximum deduction, but it does strike me as odd today. Today, I think you may be able to add money to your return for various purposes, but you don't get a credit like that. In 1983, I sold my home in Maine and moved, requiring me to pay capital gains on the sale of the house. I had paid $30,000 in 1980 and sold it for $45,000 a little over 2 years later. Not bad. 1985 saw the most significant change in my tax return and my life. Our return was now married, filing jointly, and not only did we purchase a house, the house had a business office for me, and Bill was in his first year as a sole proprietor as a dentist in downtown Worcester. Thus entered many complications and the need to calculate and pay estimated tax for Bill and withhold federal income tax, FUTA, FICA, workers' compensation, etc., on his employees. All of this was on paper back then. Along the way, I was happily able to copy my returns so that I didn't have to write the numbers down all over again. Then I could use a spreadsheet to calculate the numbers on the return. Then the software industry started offering programs that would do the tax return. Then the IRS allowed and is now pushing for returns to be filed electronically. Lots of change over the years. I've gone from one page to my official return on the software of 51 pages, or 351 pages of return plus worksheets, itemized lists, and data entry forms. So happy to be able to do this using software and electronic filing. Looking back on our tax returns over the years, they are a reflection of the complexity and the movement of our lives. I give the IRS credit that they are encouraging electronic filing by partnering with the software industry to offer free filing to taxpayers with incomes of $66,000 and less. The IRS also sponsors the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which gives those with $54,000 or less free assistance in the preparation of return. Unfortunately, the program in Rutland ended Friday. IRS also supports low-income taxpayer clinics that will help individuals in disputes with the IRS, including audits, appeals, collection matters, and federal tax litigation. A concern that I have, shared with other members of the advisory panel I served on, is that as the IRS advocates electronic filing, some taxpayers may be disadvantaged. A clear indication that it was moving away from paper was a cessation of the mailing of a 1040 form to all of those who had filed the previous year. Now supplies of the form are not as widely as available as they once were. Whether it's because they're without an internet connection or they fear having their information transmitted in a digital form, there will always be those who want to use paper for their return. Currently, that's only 10% of filers. I would like to end my reflection on taxes with how I best could use compiling of our tax return to be mindful about our finances. How does our money come in, and how does it get expended? This is not going to be full disclosure. I'd like to focus on charitable contributions. When I look at charitable contributions, I am reminded of an episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show entitled 1040 or Fight. Mary was audited by an IRS agent who kept coming back for more documentation, not because Mary was a scofflaw, but because the agent was enamored. For the documentation of one charitable deduction, Mary had a popsicle stick. Does anybody remember this episode? Oh, she had a popsicle stick. She had a story to go with it. As a volunteer taking a group of kids on a field trip, she treated them to popsicles. We don't have popsicle sticks, but we have receipts for things like the donation of a stick blender to the church auction every year, 4 Chinese restaurants for takeout served at a band concert, expenses for volunteering in Colorado on the bicycle tour, Staples printing of the wayside pulpit for the Sunday program, and contributions for other organizations that provide benefits to others. And yes, I deducted the amount that I paid her to give the sermon. Although I probably should have figured out how much of it was a benefit to me and deducted only that portion which was not a benefit to me. Compiling these is an opportunity to reflect on how we use our resources. So have a great tax day, and if you haven't filed, there is still time. If you can't complete your return by Tuesday, you still have time to file for an extension and be in the same position 6 months from now. Look on the bright side.
Yes.
Responses.